Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
And now, I would like to invite Liz Pruitt, Gabriela Camera, and Kate Sofas to the Inforum stage.
Wine.
Yes.
Bear with us a minute here. So, while we're getting started, we thought we'd set the stage informally so we can really feel like we're having a chat together at a little cafe. So I'm Kate Sofas. I'm CEO of SF Made, and we are this city's nonprofit support partner for manufacturing. And I'm so thrilled tonight to be with two friends, new and old, to talk about making and food and motherhood and being here in San Francisco. So thank you, Liz. So I'm going to introduce quickly our esteemed guests, but then I'm going to let them introduce each other. So I am toasting Liz, if you couldn't figure that one out. So Liz Pruitt is the chef and owner of Tartine Manufactory and the owner of, author owner of Tartine All Day, which you will be signing copies of afterwards. And that's your third cookbook. And Gabriela Camara is chef and owner of Kala and several other restaurants is the description, but you have restaurants here and
only in Kala here,
Mexico.
Thank goodness.
Several, yes. Is how many?
I now only have three in Mexico City, mm-hmm. because I've sold some, but I have Kala is the 11th restaurant I opened.
So that's more than several. So well done to you.
My wow. last one. I don't know.
So because I have come to learn that Gabriela and Liz are friends, I thought it would be a fun way to start is let each of them really introduce each other.
Oh.
In no particular order.
Well, we're fairly new friends. I will say I'm a great admirer of Gabriela's work, although I am so new that I have not seen her restaurant in Mexico City, although I'm dying to go there. But I've been many times to Kala. And what the original question, which I loved also, was I think, what is it that you appreciate or...
That was going to be my next one.
Enjoy about this person.
What do you most admire?
So
about
what
each other?
Admire? So what I would say is that when I got to meet Gabriela, and it was around a group of people, and she's clearly the life of the party. This is like someone, and I said, I really want to know her. Like you meet someone, you go, I want to be her friend. And that's what Gabriela was like for me. And so when I heard from my agent, she said, you know, we're going to go to Mexico City in January, and all just the three of us. And I felt like a princess that I was going to go just, we didn't quite do it yet, but we're going
to
do it.
We have to.
But that's, so to me, that Gabriela is just like effusively friendly and connected to people on such a lovely, heartfelt, genuine joyous way. And that really is what makes someone in the restaurant business so successful. And you can feel that when you go into Kala. It's a very joyful place to be and very, you can feel her presence there. And that's, but people have also said this about Mexico City, and obviously she's not living there, the place that she owns there. And that just also shows her effect on her staff and the people who work for her and, you know, the patrons who are used to going. So that's my long-winded way of showing my appreciation.
Thank you so much. I have known of you, Liz, for a long time, much longer than we have actually met. Mm. Because, of course, in Mexico City, where I used to live, I still go back and forth all the time, but coming to San Francisco to eat and to see new places was always sort of, you know, keeping in, you know, keeping up with what was going on in the world in important ways. And Tartine was, of course, a fundamental place. I mean, it's transformed bread in the world. Mm-hmm. And your pastries and, I mean, not only Chad's bread, to me, it has always been very obvious. But for me, you know, Tartine, this bakery, and then when I was thinking of moving to San Francisco, the architect that we chose to work with was working with you.
That's right. Right? That's right.
And then, anyways, and the school that we liked, that we were considering for my son, Liz's daughter was there. So then we were put in touch. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, Liz has always been very welcoming, and both you and Chad have been extremely generous. And one of the nicest things about living in San Francisco has been the generosity of this community and the acceptance of somebody who isn't from here and just has every door open, and everybody is so friendly. And this industry of, you know, feeding and taking care of others actually is very well represented with the way everybody has been. And you and Chad have been so, so incredibly amazing. And I admire so many things about Liz, but one of the things I admire a lot in a more superficial way is how attentive she is to every detail. Everything she wears, everything she says, everything she has around her. And I really appreciate that. Because I think it's in the attentiveness to details that one conveys care in our industry.
That's a pastry chef for you.
There you go.
Does that imply there are other kinds of chefs who have less attention to detail?
Perhaps.
So I'm interested, and I had the privilege to chat with a few folks before we got up here tonight, and I was curious what they were interested in. And one thing that several people said to me is people easily can assume when you have reached the level that both of you have reached in your food careers that you've always been in food since you were little. And so I think it would be interesting to share a little bit about how your childhood did or didn't influence what you've chosen to do in your lives. And I hear there's something to do with an easy bake oven that I need to ask about that specifically, yes. Liz.
I think you're referring to me, yes.
Unless they had
Did you have an easy bake oven? I wanted
an
easy bake oven.
You did?
I never had one. And look what happened to me.
Yes, I have very, very clear, fond, embarrassing
was
memories.
It the chocolate one that you would make?
Yeah. I mean, if you grew up, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I wanted one of these, as my daughter desperately wanted one of these in 2013. And I can still remember the smell of that, like, slightly burnt chocolate. It's the light bulb.
How many of you had an easy bake
Did
oven?
Everybody?
All right.
So good. At least I'm glad some people know what I'm talking about. And I think they came out around, the 60s, I'll just say. So I was an early adopter of the technology. And so, yeah, I have a lot of fond memories of those, actually.
So did you go straight into food from there? You started, you were baking birthday cakes,
I was
and
hired
here you are,
immediately.
And you were, there's a little detour in there.
Actually, I don't remember this at all, but a friend of mine from back then told me that I used to tell her that I wanted to own a bakery.
Really?
I know. It's so cute. I have no memory of this whatsoever. I always tell people I wanted to be a photojournalist, which I really, that was my dream in my early 20s. I went to the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan. And while I was a coach at Girl at Night, and I would go to school, and I did that. And I just wanted to photograph the world and work for Reuters or, you know, one of the newspapers. And I have no memory of that early Easy Bake bakery dream.
And so for you, Gabriela, what was your childhood like? Were you born in Mexico? Or Mexico
I was born
City?
In Mexico. Yep. And just continuing with the easy bake oven, I was given one because I always wanted to cook. I was always cooking.
How old were you when you got your first easy bake?
I might have been like 6, 7. Yeah. Yeah. And I did not think it was good enough. I had already experienced the real oven, so that was not...
Yeah.
Tasted fake.
You're like, I can't work with this.
but I never pursued a professional career in cooking until after I finished university. Or well,
so it sort of dissuaded you actually. From...
No, I think the easy bake was just one of my uncles that knew I, you know, liked to bake and make things. I always remember when I was a kid, everybody would say, "Wow, that girl eats like an adult." But in terms of the quantities, I don't think they were even admiring my delicacy of any type. But so I guess it was just a present for a girl who was fond of eating and cooking. But I do remember thinking, it's not really that good. You know, the stove was better. Mm-hmm. And I always enjoyed cooking and eating. And then I decided that I didn't want to become a chef, because when I had to decide on what to do, much like Liz, I had other ambitions. I thought I was going to be a curator of contemporary art. Mm-hmm. And I that's what I wanted. I never imagined opening my own restaurant and having and owning any business. Never.
Mm-hmm. So was there a point for each of you that you realized there was some connection between, in your case, your photojournalistic pursuits, and in your case, art curation? And how did that connect back to food and to the decision, actually, to invest your time and career in food?
You go.
I'd gone to the SVA, and I was doing all this, and my boyfriend at the time... I remember saying to me, you know, when you have a day off, it's you're not taking pictures, you're always cooking. And I realized that I was always looking at, I was 28 at the time when I, wait, no, what was I? 26 when I went into culinary school. And I was definitely like a full, 8 years older than anybody else who attended, because it was mostly guys. I was one woman in a class of like 19 guys. And now I understand it's like 50-50. Mm-hmm. It's much, much better. But I wanted to, I lost my train of thought.
When did you decide that you were going to do this professionally?
Yeah. And that's the first time that's ever happened. Of course, it's on the radio. We
never lose track.
And so anyway, I just I decided at that time that I was going to go to culinary school, which I always thought of as like more of as like a vo-tech school, because but I knew that because of my age, in order to get ahead and not be stuck peeling potatoes for the rest of my life in a kitchen, that I needed to do that. That's what I felt like I needed to do at the time. So I went to culinary school, and on my my internship, I was working at this restaurant that's closed since, but it was called Montrachet in New York City. And the owner, one day we were like plating something for like this huge party we were doing, and I was putting the plates out and we were plating something up, and the owner, Drunie Perrant, said, "Someday you're going to own Liz's place." And it was like this moment that like...
That's the moment.
It was like lightning struck me. And inside my head, I went, "Yes, I am." And he would have like no idea. It was like such a throwaway thing to say. Like, he was just like, "Good going, kid," you know. But I was like, "Yes, I am." And they were so encouraging and welcoming, and they let me stay well past my externship was over. And I just, that was really when I decided, like, that's what I want to do. I liked that feeling. Like, mm-hmm. I like feeding people. I like this. I'm really competitive. It feels like every check mark for me. I'm like competitive. I like to bake. I like to cook. And I like to feed people. And
that was when I realized.
Isn't it ironic that in so many cultures, and including our own, women are such in the kitchen and yet so underrepresented, particularly at that time in the elite ranks of chefs, right? Did you have a moment like that, Gabriela, or was it more
I an never evolution? Had a moment like that. It just happened to me. I mean, I was in university. I always assumed I would cook and eat well because that's how I had grown up. In Mexico, usually, I mean, people are very fond of food. And my mother's Italian, so that was very encouraging as well. I mean, there's nothing, everything is around the table. Everything happened around the table, and you're finished eating, and you're talking about what we're going to have for dinner, and then for breakfast, and then everything. So food was so important. I guess it was so in my face that I didn't have to. I never thought of actually going to a school to study about it. And one day we were, I love fishing and going to the beach, and we spent vacations in one particular beach in Mexico with a bunch of friends. And they said, well, you know what? We're going to just, let's just open a restaurant. And they made it happen. And one day we were there looking at spaces, and I knew exactly how I wanted it, and I knew exactly how I wanted the tables to be in the. And I just, it just sort of happened. I would have never done it on my own, but I was a group of friends, and they were ready to do it. And one day I found myself owning, you know, being an owner of a restaurant.
And were any of them involved?
Yes, one of them was, because he was coming back from Italy. He was sick and tired of working at the Fiat office is. And he came back from Italy and said, okay, let's do it. Let's do it this spring. I'm going to be here. I have full time to do it. And I was still studying at the university. I was still working at the National Museum of Art in the afternoons. But everything about this restaurant, it's called Contramar. It's in Mexico City. We started in 1998. Everything
she
about it.
She was 23 years old when she had her first restaurant.
So it really was a fluke. I happened to be very good at it because I was also, I loved the social part of it, which you never think of that part when you think of going to culinary school.
Mm-hmm, no. Not that, nor the business side.
Right. and then I found myself with a restaurant, and now, of course, all the other partners are not a part of the restaurant anymore because I was the only one who actually took it seriously and made it happen and it became an important restaurant in the city because I had all these notions, many of which I had taken from Chez Panisse in Berkeley and Europe and eating fresh and local, and that was very innovative in Mexico City.
Had you been
City.
To Chez Panisse, or you knew about it?
I had been. That was an important moment in my life because I did realize that somebody was really thinking about what you were eating. Mm.
So both of you are from somewhere else and came to California in some ways in pursuit of something around food. Was it the chefs? Was it Alice Waters? Was it the sense that somehow California had more permissiveness to do something different? Why? What drew you here? And really recently, maybe I'll start with you, Gabriela. This is not an easy city. In a lot of ways, we are open and we are excited and we are accepting and we are so expensive. And we are so expensive.
It is the worst business decision anybody could make.
Right. So I'm dying to know.
I wish you'd talk to me.
Welcome and thank you. But no. It's not easy, particularly right now, right?
Listen, and I were talking about how we had opened in such different moments, right? I opened Cala a year and a half ago. Right in the middle of this.
And where is it exactly?
Cala is on Fell Street.
Who's been to Cala before? Oh, you've got like 100 new customers here. So
anyways,
where is Cala?
Cala is in Civic Center, very close to the new Jazz Center, on Fell Street between Franklin and Van Ness, 149 Fell Street. This is a great advertisement. Thank you very much.
And the concept is?
Is Mexican seafood. And it was a series of things that brought me to the United States to do something. I was going to do something in New York. And then the father of my child wanted to move to San Francisco instead of New York. And I thought, okay, I didn't know much about San Francisco, except for that I had been a tourist in San Francisco many times. And I had come to, you know, on periods to Berkeley with my parents because they had been teaching there. And then I had just it was important. If you were in the culinary world in any way, San Francisco was very relevant. And it was a place of, you know, bountiness and wonderful ingredients and great farms and the wine country. And as you know, anybody in the world who's into food and comes to the United States wants to go to San Francisco. And I never realized how difficult it was going to be to open a restaurant in San Francisco until actually I was already living here. I had my school, you know, my son in school, and I found myself opening a restaurant in a city where nobody can afford to live in. Most of the people who work in restaurants can't afford to live in the city. So I have gone through extreme and creative measures to make it work, and I'm actually really happy I've done it. It's been difficult. Of course it's a challenge, but it's been, I think, as good as it can be. And it was not an obvious decision. It was not, I think, anybody, you know, everybody was, all my friends from New York were, the whole first year that I was here, what are you doing in San Francisco? Just come to New York. Life is normal here. Mm-hmm. And friends from LA. And actually, I think that I've done something in San Francisco that is really different from what was here. And also, in terms of Mexican food, I was very, not nervous, but I didn't want to come and show what Mexican food is, because you have your own tradition of Mexican food in San Francisco. I knew I didn't want a restaurant in the Mission because I didn't want to do another Mexican restaurant in the Mission. And, you know, we source everything locally, and we use only seasonal ingredients, and we bring very few things from abroad, a few chiles from Mexico, wines from Europe, South America, but we really try to, I mean, we, it's sort of a cliche California, Northern California restaurant in a way, but it is Mexican seafood. And I think Tartine helped establish that. Or when you came to California, maybe it was there was also a romanticized version, right?
There is a romanticized version, which I think we were able to get away with more when we started in, because we opened in 2002. And the just the politics of the city have changed so much in that short period of time. But I have so many comments that I want to make.
Yes.
Because, number one, this is, Gabriela says we're a seafood restaurant, Mexican seafood restaurant. This is how incredible this place is to me. The first time I went, and I love food of all kinds, and I will eat food of any type, and I happily go to Mexico and eat traditional food. But what I had the first time at Gabriela's, and every time thereafter, but there was a tamale, or a tamal, as is more, yes, I'm so sorry, a tamal, forgive me, and it was a tamal that had, she had put it together, you're going to correct me if I'm wrong, but with raw mussels in the shell, and when it's steamed, you have this tamal that, as it steamed, the mussels would open up and exude their juices. And you would have these perfectly cooked, amazing mussels inside this, I don't know what your masa is made out of, but
corn.
Not like, it's corn masa, but it is not what they're using at any other place in the Mission. And this beautiful, sweet, and these plump, and the juices coming out. And I was like, that is something that someone, you could see how smart she was to think of. It was brilliant. Now you're going to tell me this is like a typical thing that they make in Mexico. <Yes. laughs>
I wish I could say yes, I'm brilliant, but no. Actually,
it is not.
It's a, what is it, water racket, you call that? They're in a part of Oaxaca where the salty, where the ocean.
Brackish.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. They have these an abundance of mussels, and they make a type of tamal. It's different from the one I make at Cala,
yeah.
But it's the mussels are cooked in the when they're steamed.
Right.
So, I got that idea from there.
This is, I doubt anybody here is doing anything like this. And so and there's like everything that you can order at Cala is like thoughtful and different. And this is, okay, so there's that.
Thank you, Liz. And then, oh, you were talking, and I had all these other things that I wanted to jump in
the
and
moment,
say.
The different moment, the idealization of San Francisco.
Oh, yes, yes.
There's the idealization.
This is why Liz invited me today.
Well, we were talking about California, mm-hmm. and you've been here a little bit longer. But
well, how welcoming it is here, and that's what I want, because you touched on that earlier too. And it's a really interesting aspect that I hadn't thought of before you mentioned that, and that is that so many chefs will say to me that they'll go to New York, and it's so hard to break in there. It is not really what you would call an open, you know, hospitable, wonderful mm-hmm. place for anybody to come and, like, try stuff out. A few here and there, but it's harder. But contrast San Francisco, and I find it very different. Mm-hmm. Granted that you can get over the hurdles of the high rent, and which they're dealing with in New York, too, but there's more of an aspect, I don't know, in New York, you can sort of, like, go in, and there's just, like, some crappy little place on the corner, and you can clean it up and be like Judy Garland, and like, let's open up a restaurant or a bakery. Let's open a show. Here, it's a little more complicated, but I will say that there is this more sort of openness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, your newest physical restaurant, the Manufactory mm-hmm. itself, is sort of a collaboration in the space and with community. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, since we wanted to talk about food and what you two are both working on as community.
Well, so Tartine Manufactory is in San Francisco's Mission District. It is something that we opened this last August of 2016. And we wanted to find a way to expand everything that we were doing at the bakery, where really by accident you could see people making the food, and we were making the food in really small batches, into the oven, out of the oven. If you're, you know, lucky that you were able to get this one batch of croissants, and then you might have to wait for 3 minutes, and then the next batch comes out. And all of that was really just simply for practical reasons. We went to an auction, and we happened to find a refrigerator that was clear on both sides. And so we installed that. And so you could see them making the food on one side, putting it through, and opening the door on the other side. And that was purely by accident. I mean, I saw it, and I thought, oh, that would be a good idea. Let's do that. But that was how the idea presented itself, because we couldn't afford anything, so we had to go to auction. And then, of course, if you've been there, you see the bread coming out of the oven, and people gather around, and they try talking to the bakers, and the bakers are taking the bread out of the oven because we have no space to work or for people to wait to use our restroom. So that's how that worked. And so, but we realized that what we had here was we're making food in front of people, and it's inconvenient to have to wait for that batch of whatever to come out of the oven, but at the same time, you're seeing it coming out of the oven and being unmolded onto the loader and doused in sugar or sliced or whatever it is that we're doing. And we wanted to be able to take that idea and make it bigger, because it's the aspect of something being really fresh, which actually in the bakery business is not the easiest thing to find. Mm. Typically, bakers, to have those morning buns and croissants and pain au chocolat, they're baking overnight. And so there's a typical midnight shift. And so by the time you're getting that croissant, it's been 8 hours or so out of the oven very often. So we wanted to find a way around that. And we also didn't want to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, there's an actual bakery not far down the street from where you are, Panorama, that does exactly that. That at 3 a.m. you'll see their stuff.
And there's actually, like, I do have fond memories of being in Paris and seeing, like, those bakers, or you know, you're walking on the streets,
but you're like, but I don't want to be one of those.
And you're like, look, they're making baguettes. But we just, for strictly, because we started just the two of us in Point Reyes Station, and we just didn't have any employees, and we started selling at the farmers markets, and we're like, you know what, just for our own sense of sanity, we can't bake that way. And so that's where that started.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So in a lot of ways, you know, the work that we do at SF Made, and now actually Tartine is technically also a manufacturer because of the bakery that you do out of the manufactory. A lot of it we talk about is sort of externalizing the craft and the work and the people who make the product or bake the product and making that more transparent to the consumer.
Well, so yeah, so thanks for getting me back on track. So that's what we wanted to expand upon at Manufactory was now we want 5,000 square feet as opposed to the 2,500 that we have at 18th and Guerrero. And we wanted, sort of like it reminds me of like one of those old Richard Scarry books that you, the kids' books, where you can see the airplane come in and then you see the little guy in the boat and the, you know, you can see everybody doing everything. And I wanted my ice cream shop over here and we wanted to see the people making the salads that you were eating for lunch. And then we have front and center the big oven. So we have like a little bit of a buffer zone so people can't like go straight up to the bakers and, you know, talk to them. You can still talk to them though. But we wanted to see all of that in action.
Well, and I don't know, how many of you have been to the manufacturer yet? So some. And it's done in community with other maker manufacturers. So next door is Cease Ceramics, and you have a number of other smaller local manufacturers and makers on the ground floor and the upper floor. So
well, and
it
that was an interesting part of being in that part of the city is when we were first talking to Robin and Kathy, who own Heath Ceramics, is one of the stipulations of being this part of the city in this particular building is that you need to actually be manufacturing. And a certain footprint of that building has to be to that end. And so when we were working with our architect that introduced Gabby and myself, we made the space with that in mind, both to fulfill the obligation to the city, but also to have this sort of different experience of walking into a space and not having a dividing line to really be able to walk through the space and see people doing things. And that fulfilled, you know, the requirements of the city to have manufacturing and then to be part of Heath. And so to be able to sit inside manufactory, we have our oven, and then to see their huge kilns working to making their ceramics and then having people upstairs. There's jewelry maker and all sorts of artists and makers of different kinds. It's super.
So when you think about, you know, and I want to go now to Gabriela was desperately afraid she was going to be late tonight, and I will tell you why in a minute. But, you know, it comes back to people and being able to showcase the people and the craft, whether it's baking or other kinds of things, and making it more clear to those of us who have the privilege of eating who has made our food. And the reason that Gabriela was concerned she would be late tonight was she happened to be at a hiring fair up with some of my team, who you met, at San Quentin. And, you know, we talk a lot and we read a lot about the expense of being in the Bay Area, and I certainly, you know that many chefs, prominent chefs, have now talked about the real concerns should we implement some of the draconian immigration reform, if you want to call it that, that it would have such an incredibly adverse effect on the restaurant business. And so when we think about diversity and inclusion of diversity in the workforce of restaurants, I mean, it seems like the food industry is really an emblem for being welcoming and being a place where people, whether you're coming out of San Quentin or you're coming from Tijuana, that you have an opportunity. So I would love to have you share a little bit about what drew you to go to San Quentin today, and how do you think about your work as a platform for opportunity for people?
Okay, so when I got into the world of restaurants, it was always very clear to me that the most important asset in restaurants was not only a genius chef or a, you know, or a person thinking or curating a menu or a style or a design of menus, but the people, the team in the restaurants. The team is the real possibility of making a restaurant extraordinary. And when I came to San Francisco, and in the restaurant in Mexico, you know, and in Mexico, you restaurants have the capability of taking people with very little training, and if you're a good worker and if you're a hard worker, you move ahead and you can get along really far if you are hardworking and good at what you do. So restaurants are generous that way. Not only generous because they feed people, but also because they can. Anybody who is willing to work in a restaurant actually pretty much can work in a restaurant. And when I came to San Francisco, one of my biggest concerns was how I was going to find people to work, because I knew about all the city, you know, the crisis in the city of not having enough people to work in the industry of restaurants that had already been open and successful. And I spoke to all these friends and business owners and restaurant owners and chefs who had been really struggling to find a good team. And Emma Rosenbusch, who worked with me because fate is incredible, and I met her in Mexico City, and she was planning to move back to San Francisco, and she wanted to work with me because she had no experience in the restaurant world in the United States, and she wanted to work with me, and I hired her part-time. She had worked at a prison law office before she went down to Mexico, where I met her. So she said, Gabriela, would you? So I said, we need to find people who care about this job. Because the thing is, when you get to a crisis in which nobody can afford to live with the pay that restaurants offer, you need people for whom this job can be meaningful. You need people for whom this job can actually make a difference. And she said, I have it. Will you be willing to hire people with a conviction history? And I said, of course. I've hired people with conviction history in Mexico from day one, because those are the people who are available. And here it's very organized. It's very complex. So, you know, Emma started moving all her contacts, looking into today Emma is the general manager of Cala, and she's my partner, and I adore her. I owe so much of Cala to her, or Cala owes so much of what it is to her. But so Emma started, you know, working with the city of San Francisco and all her different, there's so much support, and the level of recidivism. And, you know, Emma was aware of all this because of her previous job. She was a clerk at an office. I mean, she wasn't even a lawyer. She was just, it happened to be that she was aware of this issue, and the crisis in the prisons in the country and in the city and in the state, but the really high levels of recidivism in the city of San Francisco, where people could not find a job and then they would go back to, you know, being in prison, and it's just a really bad circle. So we started hiring people with a conviction history, and it's been a ride. It's been interesting, to say the least. And I really do think it's been much more, it's made Cala much more meaningful on so many levels. And also, I think since I didn't have, you know, I wasn't a part of the community here, so I had the liberty to begin that. And I think if you had a restaurant that had started 10 years before, you didn't see that as an option because you hadn't needed it. So now many friends who have restaurants that have been successful before in the Bay Area are now looking into this because it's an option. You have all these inmates who are ready, who have served their time, who are ready to go out, and they have nobody that wants to hire them. So restaurants are a good way, and some of them work out, some of them don't. And you know, imprisonment and incarceration is such a complex subject because it doesn't have to do only with a crime. It has to do with the way people are brought up, the context in which they live, the, you know, race, education. It has to do with so many things. But I have been a huge supporter of hiring people with a conviction history, and the level of recidivism, not because of me, of course, but it's just a whole movement that is happening now. You know, SF Made, and many people are hiring. And there's so many volunteers in that are working for this, for the city of San Francisco and in all these organizations. There has been so much support for businesses who hire this, you know, hire people with coming out of prison. And it's just extraordinary how the level of recidivism has really gone down in the past 3 years. It really, yeah, amazing. And at, for example, at St. Quentin, where I just went now, they have started doing, Diane Williams, this extraordinary woman who volunteers there, has a project that has to do with preparing the inmates that are about to get out for their job interviews. Because one of the things that happens is that they go out and they don't know how to speak about themselves. They don't want to say that they've been in prison. They don't want to talk about what crime they committed. I usually don't even want to know what crime they committed because you don't want to know. But as long as, you know, they serve their time and they're out, it's fine. I think many, many more times the crime is, many more times the habits that they have and their issues with drug abuse or alcohol abuse are so much more important or relevant for their capability of engaging in society than a specific crime. But anyways, that's a whole other issue.
So this is an area where I would have said Gabby invented this, because I never heard of it. I didn't know that you could
Lucky
do this.
Lucky you own Tartine. Everybody wants to work with you. Who is going to want to work in a new Mexican restaurant? Nobody. So, I actually now, Liz and I share some of the workers, because some of the amazing people that work with Liz, because it really is an extraordinary team, want to work at Cala because they want to be supportive of these other members of society, and they train them, and they're amazing.
But it does.
Trainers.
It speaks to community. I mean, we see, not far from actually the manufactory is one of our other manufacturers, Charles Chocolate, and they hire folks who, some of whom have been incarcerated and some of whom have experience as pastry chefs and have moved into chocolate. So I think when we look at community, it's a pretty expansive concept. And I guess with that, one thing that we also share, all three of us in common, is we have young children in the city. So I'm wondering, how does being a mom, being a parent, inform your work and your expression of your art, through your food?
Well, so for me, and I've said this before, but when we had our daughter Archer in 2007, she was born with a disability. And so I stopped working immediately. And she was born with cerebral palsy, which really required some research and just like slowing down and figuring out what to do. And it's the type of thing that you really don't know what the next thing will be that she can or she can't do, and like what kind of medical intervention that you might need. And so it really made us slow down as a family, and I stepped back from our work. Fortunately, we're a couple, and we both own Tartine, and Chad was able to go back to work. And she was a preemie, and so I stayed in New York where she was born, and Chad was able to go back to work. And so this, the day she was born, it was clear that I needed to figure something else out. I had already, we'd been wanting to have a kid, and I thought, well, let's write our first cookbook and figure out if we can even just like get me out of the kitchen, because I was in production every day, like all of our other bakers, and see if I can even do that and train somebody and be in charge of the kitchen, somebody besides me. And that worked out great. And we wrote the first cookbook. And so when Archer came along and I got pregnant, I thought, okay, we can do this. There's like a plan. There's like, I've seen families who've done this before, and everybody's nodding and laughing because anything can happen. And it did. And it derailed in a sense, but in a sense, I was also able to figure out this other path of life that it led me down. And I started a nonprofit to raise funds to send kids with disabilities to a summer camp, a 6-week summer camp that we formed. And so that was, in a sense, I maybe shouldn't use the word a derailment, because it just sent me down a different path. And some people didn't even know that I was away from the bakery, because Chad was able to be there on a day-to-day basis, and we had a wonderful team carry on with everything that I started. And then when I came back, which was really around the time when I started this new cookbook and putting Manufactory together,
some people didn't know I was away. Some people, you know, that,
well,
that
done
was
you.
A testament to how good our staff was. And I was really trying to figure out, like, this is not an uncommon thing. Women and men step back all the time when they have a family. So how do you get back into your work life? And I was fortunate because I created my own little world that I could step back into. But even that was, you know, I'm not going to bake every day. I'm starting this new thing, and they're not used to me in that role. It was really like I felt like a lot of like stops and starts and trying to figure out what it was. Fortunately, I had this cookbook to work on, and so that was a daily thing, and that was a thing that I could really just put all of my creative energy into and just cook every single day. And that's really what I love to do. And to Instagram it. And
now the kind of, the cookbook is
a new part of the creative process.
My
who knew?
Greatest admiration for Liz's Instagramming. I'm so bad.
And we'll be signing the cookbook later, and I've read portions of it now, and as also a mom of also mm-hmm. a kid with disabilities, mm-hmm. You know, you sort of balance the work and the life and the cooking, and yeah. So is the lens of Tartine every day really aimed at people who are busy and need to kind of have mm-hmm. recipes broken down for them? How do you orient the book, would you
well,
say?
Well, I guess, I mean, for the book, it's stuff that I was cooking at home, both for home, but also with manufacturing in mind. Mm-hmm. And with manufacturing in mind, it was, you know, we're not serving really complicated foods. It's very fresh salads and, you know, sandwiches made on Chad's bread. So it all really dovetailed nicely together. I wasn't making complicated reduction sauces that required, you know,
like days
of, you know, preparation and know-how. So everything sort of came together in a nice way in that respect.
And Gabriel, you have a son. Does he appreciate what you do? Do you see future food industry person in him, or how does he?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely. I mean, I think I've always been very responsible with how I think the world should eat and how I eat. But definitely having a son makes you, or having kids makes you be much more conscious of how kids are raised or kids eat. And I've always been very, one of my favorite stories of Lucas, my son, is that he didn't know what McDonald's was when he was 5 years old.
Well done.
Yeah. And I never made it a point, but he never had been. And he's like, Mama, what's McDonald's? I'm like, wow, you don't know what it is. It's great. But, and then we had to go, and he hated it, fortunately. But he liked the games. Anyways, the point being, when I opened this restaurant, this is the first restaurant I had also, you know, when you have the choice and you are a mother, you want to spend time with your kids. And I think that this is, you know, the beauty of civilized countries is that you can spend time with your kids. And the first restaurant I opened after Lucas was born is, well, I had opened one, but I didn't really, I wasn't the chef there. I wasn't in charge. And so the first restaurant I opened was Kala. And Lucas was 6 years old, and he could not be more proud. And he, every time after school, he wanted to go to Kala. And he's like, Mama, our restaurant is going to be really full tonight, right? And he would stand there. And I promise you, I thought, you know, between hiring ex-cons and having my son there, they're going to think I'm like child labor, you know, everything bad. But Lucas was so proud of it, and he loves the food, and he was so proud of being Mexican, but not, he was always very offended of, Mama, why are they asking me if you're going to make burritos? Like, we don't eat burritos. Well, no, burritos are from the north of Mexico, and we're...
I was there one night, and you were having a parent-teacher conference.
You combine things.
Because this is what we do in
this
our businesses.
This is what we do. I mean, you combine things. I couldn't leave the restaurant, so then my son was more at the restaurant.
No, I think, you know, it speaks to it, being a mom, being a parent, being an entrepreneur. It's messy.
It's very messy.
And I think anyone who considers entrepreneurship, whether it's food or ceramics, you know, you have to sort of accept it's a messy business. But that's
You're juggling with so many things at the same time, and that's just what yeah, life becomes that all the time. Mm-hmm.
So I can see our prompt in the corner. So I think we are about to enter soon a Q&A time. So I am told that folks who have questions for our panel can start lining up in the back. And while you're doing that, I'm going to steal a question from someone that I met just a few minutes before we got started, because I thought it was such an interesting question, and that buys us time for a few other people to line up. So the question is, I don't know, how many people read the recent article on millennials and avocado toast? Right, so you know, for those of you who didn't, and basically the gist was, if millennials would just stop eating that darn avocado toast, they would be able to buy a house by now, right? but it made me, and as we were chatting, think about the question was, so avocado toast seems to be everywhere now, and it wasn't a few years ago, and before that it was something else, and exactly. So it's become in vogue. You grew up with it. And then no one knew about it, and certainly growing up in Buffalo, I was joking, you know, the only vegetable we had was iceberg lettuce, so, you know, avocado was a new thing when I moved out here 30 years ago. But the question really was, how much do preeminent chefs or restaurants inform what we eat or what becomes popular? And how much is it the other way around? Like, we didn't see avocado toast is everywhere now, and it wasn't even a few years ago. So
I'm an avocado toast apologist. When I want something fast to eat and I'm like running through manufacturing, I reach for the avocado toast, and we make a really good one. I mean,
but where did it come from? Like, it originally was as,
pizza's not going out of style.
So who's that? I mean, we talk about fashion, right? You see the runways, and then that somehow informs that we all need to wear, you know, plaid pants or something. Like,
right.
Is the food industry actually setting the trends, or?
I kind of think that in a way, yes. I mean, it's not that it wasn't there, but when people start being into, you know, superfoods and not, you know, not proteins that are not from animal. And, you know,
chia seeds.
Yeah, but then like a sprouted bread with avocado is a perfect, with a little, you know, a little bit of olive oil and lemon.
It's chili perfect. Pepper thing. And chili pepper on the top.
And it's perfect. And it is delicious. It's one of the very delicious things that is actually also very healthy. So it's sort of, it goes together. It's not that it wasn't there, but it's that it has everybody's attention because it makes sense in a context.
It's the blackened redfish of 2017.
All right, I hope I did your question justice. So so in the back, I think we have a question.
Okay, Liz, you're gluten-free. What's your favorite flour for making gluten-free products?
So I'm going to, like, on the heels of that, say I am gluten-free, but I actually get sick if I eat gluten. It's not like a trend for me. I've known since like 1987. Just want to get that out of the way. So what is my flour of choice? I love avocado.
And we have our answer.
Oh my God. Avocado flour. Of course.
I think there's future there.
I love almond flour. Almond flour. What else?
Almond flour at home, or do you need to really?
Yeah, that's the
buy
one
it
that
I've never
I would
used it.
Buy. There's, I mean, you can process small amounts in like a regular coffee mill. But it can quickly turn into almond butter, so you have to be careful. And there's a couple of companies that make a really nice almond flour.
Do you order it online, or can you get it?
No, just go to anywhere.
Yeah,
everybody carries Bob's Red Mill now.
Okay. In San Francisco.
I hate to say like a brand, but really, it's at Safeway, it's at Whole Foods, it's everywhere.
Yeah. All right.
Hi there, you guys. Thank you so much for coming. The food was delicious, and we love having you here. Question is for Gabriela. So I have a question. So the people that you're hiring in your restaurant, do they have no experience in the restaurant industry? Are you training them on everything? And does that affect your menu items at all?
So, yeah, the people that we hire, usually the people that we hire that have been previously incarcerated have no experience. And yes, it does affect, no, it doesn't affect the items on our menu. It affects maybe the explanation of the items on our menu. and it affects, no, I mean, other people have experience and we try to have a really thorough training process. But it is, I mean, it is an investment. It is a difference than when you hire somebody who knows how wine is made. Here, these people don't know that wine is made from grapes.
Yeah, no, that's phenomenal. Kidding. And like, that makes me appreciate the food even more. So thank you.
Thank you.
It's amazing. You guys all have to try it.
Thank you.
I have a few questions that came from the audience and from social media before the program. And this is for both Liz and for Gabriela. What is a piece of advice that you would give yourself if you knew what you know now, starting when you opened your first restaurant?
To always do what my gut feeling told me to do.
That's good. I would say, well, advice to myself, like a younger self, would be to say yes to more things. I would tend to be like, I'm not sure about that, and, you know, hang back a little or like stick with what I knew. But saying yes to things is, it just opens up more, like even if it's just like a lunch or a dinner with someone or meeting a new person or come and talk to this group of people or whatever. I always felt like I reaped so much from that opportunity of saying yes.
So I want to follow on with that. What's the biggest mistake you made? Which is not to say you regret it. But what's the thing that's like, yeah, that probably wasn't the way it was going to work out, and yet in the spirit of experimentation,
opening a restaurant,
you're still glad
maybe?
You did it.
I had no idea. I could have just kept on eating and cooking well.
Is it harder here or in Mexico City?
It's different.
Yeah.
I think it's always hard, but it's different. And that's why it's only for people who really, really love it, because even if it's hard, you love it.
How about you, Liz?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wish I had really delved into what I knew in my heart was what I wanted to do earlier. But sometimes, you know, what I feel like I know what I want to do in my heart is to go into acting, because I went to acting school for years. And so you don't know, really, is the answer. You don't know sometimes what the mistake is.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what the mistake
good one.
Is.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Another question in the back.
Hi. Yes. This is for both of you. Sorry. Good. Okay. At both of your establishments, what would you say is the most exciting or the signature thing that anybody who visits shouldn't pass up? And then to tail on that would be, with what frequency or like how invested are you in trying to add new things to the menu to keep it exciting?
For both of us?
Yes.
You want to go?
Well, so to keep it exciting, so what I found when I did step back and I had my daughter and everybody was like really well trained and they were executing beautifully, and then it's like suddenly years go by and the menu's not changing. And you can fall into that too, where like, you know, we know we have to have ham croissants on the menu, but there is an area where not only for the guest, but for yourself and for the people who work for you, you need to allow people to show their creativity.
and to have that sense of pride and experimentation. And so there is a balance of things that you know you have to execute on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, ride that line of keeping it fun and exciting, because that's, food is fun and exciting.
So is that kind of the ice cream in part?
Oh yeah, ice cream in part for sure for me was something that I wanted to do, because I'm like, what can I make besides a cookbook that's gluten-free?
And if you haven't tried the ice cream yet,
the printed word and ice cream.
And ice cream. So for you?
And for me, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Liz. You do new things, not only because you always want... I guess if you're curious, you're always thinking of new things. And that's how menus start, because you think of things that would be interesting together, and then you try them and they work and people like them. And it's a constant experimentation that keeps, you know, that keeps places going always. And a lot for the team, when you have a good team, they're always creating things. They come up with ideas. You go to the market, you see something new. So it's sort of, if a restaurant is working well, you will always have new things coming on. And you will also have things that you can't take off a menu. Like, you're not going to take off a menu the morning bun. I mean, mm-hmm. You would kill many people of that come everywhere as a pilgrimage from everywhere in the world for that morning bun to tartine. But, and for example, I have the sort of certain things in the menu that I can't take off, because...
What can you not take off?
The trout tostada, for example, here. Why would I take it off? It's sustainable all the time. It's, you know, it's farm trout. Everybody loves it. Mm. There's nothing wrong with it on any count in any time of the year. And people love it. So, or why would I take off the sweet potato?
Oh.
I mean, certain things. But you add on. It doesn't mean that you don't add on. You just, you always add on.
Liz, right? What's the item you can't take off?
Oh, the morning bun.
The morning bun. Okay. Another question?
Yeah. We're going to take just two more questions.
Two more questions.
I'm curious what each of you think about the startups that send the boxes with the ingredients and the recipes.
You don't even need to speak.
Does that exist?
We're going to answer in mime.
I have to say, I do a lot of miming.
Then please.
It increases as I finish my glass of wine. So I accidentally got one of these boxes. I had always sort of been curious, like intellectually curious, like, oh, maybe I'll sign up for one of these just to see what it's like. Yeah. So I accidentally got... I'm not going to say which one, because there's so many, and I can't remember. It was one of them. So we got the box, and I didn't have time to actually bring it to the
person.
But
accidentally, like, did somebody give it to you?
It was delivered accident to our house.
Accidentally on purpose.
And it's this, like, fresh food.
Okay.
And so I was like, let's just open it up and see what this is all about. And this made me crazy. There was an egg in it, and it had... This is tipping the hand, but it came from Denver. I don't know, whatever company is in Denver. And so it was an egg from California. And it was one egg. It was raw. And it was, or maybe it was cooked. And it was wrapped up in one, like, unit of plastic and then bubble wrap around it. It was from California. It had been sent to Denver. And then it had been sent... to my address. And then there was, like, you know, meat and fresh vegetables that probably also came from California and all this other stuff.
It had been sent to Denver
and
sent
it was
back.
Fine, but it was astonishing to me that people were doing this when you can get all this shit. I was told I could have one. At your local whatever, you know, CSA,
it's
box,
never a party
farmer's
till
market.
Someone starts swearing. Yeah. So thank you for opening that up.
No more wine.
So I know we have to keep on rolling. So I guess our last question.
Okay, this question for Liz. I know you can answer no comment, but I was curious about the Blue Bottle Tartine merger. Yeah, sorry.
Yep. What you wanted to say.
Be specific.
Either who called it off or what happened. Your choice.
It was called off.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And there we go.
Fair enough. Thank you.
But what I was really interested in was this last question that you said you were going to inquire about. Have you been thinking about it?
Have you?
Yes, I have.
The 60-second
idea? And I have
an
answer. I have an answer.
Okay. All right. So your idea that will change the world.
No, you have thought about it. Okay, since you have the answer. I'm still thinking.
So I'm going to add to that. Your idea and one recipe to go with the idea that will change the world.
Whoa. Well, you're going to laugh when I say what it is.
All right, do it.
So my idea, and I was thinking in a more humorous vein, because I tend to go there, but this is what I'm going to say, is my idea to change the world is I would wish in an ideal world for everybody to see a whatever born, let's say a cow, to see a calf born, to see how it's raised, to see how it's weaned, to see its relationship with its mother, and how it's grown, and what it's fed, and to touch it, and to experience that animal, and then to see it sent off to the abattoir where it's slaughtered, and to see how it's slaughtered, and not miss 1 minute of this life, and then to see how it's broken down and what happens to it after that and gone to market.
Yep.
I was actually thinking
that it's similar in a less, something that would change the world. And I thought, if we could all look at each other with empathy and we could actually all look at each other as equals or in the complexity and the simplicity of everybody. And that has to do with...
You have the Marina Abramovich answer.
to actually look at others as if they were as important as you, as you know, to actually consider otherness as a part of you, mm-hmm. and that's also, it has to do with
the connection between people,
and it has to, but with everything in the world, and it has to do with seeing the process and accepting the complexity of a beautiful calf, and then you eat a steak. Mm-hmm. I mean, those who can.
So I want to add in, you know, it's funny, I was eating lunch earlier today and looked at the place I was at and how many people were looking at their devices, their cell phones, their iPads while they were eating. And my wish is that we can reconnect with food as community and that we can all, every one of us, myself included, stop using our devices when we eat, even if we're alone, and really appreciate the food we have, appreciate the people we're with, or appreciate just the nutrition that we get from eating the calf that has grown up, that becomes our sustenance. For me, that would be something right now that I think all of us can kind of take away from today and really go a little bit deeper when we appreciate a meal that someone has prepared for us. So with that, I want to recognize again Gabriela Camara and Liz Pruitt, and Liz will be signing autographed copies of her new book. And thank you for joining us tonight, and please stay.
Thank you.